Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Subject close to both our hearts.
Well, before that, I think I have to draw attention to the fact that you're no longer wearing your jumper. Is this a seasonal thing? You sort of take
it's
it off.
Summer. It's raining outside. But yes. Well, I've got a bit. It has to be washed occasionally.
But apparently, with the success of this podcast, sales of Marks and Spencer's green jumpers have gone through the roof.
They have, but I have also now my tank top, which I will be putting on later.
God, fashion icons. We both are.
It is.
Sure.
It is.
He said no it, is blue. It is blue Marks and Spencer's jumper. But yes, enough of the clothing. Yes, Rudolf Hess. I'm really looking forward to this show because, well, I've written a book about 1940. I've written a book about 1942. And I'm writing a book about 1945. But this is about 1941. And that's a year not many people talk about. And lots of interesting things happen.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and I think people forget just how close we were to possibly throwing in the towel.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about. Do you want to do a quick recap of where we are first, just to let people know?
Yes, well, the Rudolf Hess was a Nazi leader who flew to Britain in May 1941, ostensibly on a peace mission. And we're going to talk to John Harris, who is a historian who's written now, I think, seven books on the case.
Very forensically. On this one case?
Yeah, yeah. New stuff going back over 30 years.
Wow.
And does find incredible new things. He's an amateur historian. I think he would admit, but he has found some amazing things, putting two and two together. And so I'm interested because clearly it plays into my research on the royal family and the war and the sympathies towards certainly Germany, if not the Nazis. So I'd be very interested to hear what he has to say. I've read the book, which is very good, quite detailed. I mean, you almost need to read it twice to really get the full significance, but he certainly pushed the story forward.
Well, that's right. I mean, some other background for those who don't know. Hess was a diehard Nazi. He was with Hitler right at the beginning. He was in the party all the way through, got into government, became the deputy leader of Germany. So a very important man. And then just one day disappears, turns up in Scotland, part of a country that Germany is at war with. And apparently comes with a peace proposal. And wants to meet Duke Hamilton?
Yep.
Duke of Hamilton? Which, of course, makes everybody wonder, had there been some kind of secret contact being going on between people in the British aristocracy, possibly even on the fringes of the royal family, possibly even the royal family itself, about ending this war? Well, what nobody in Britain knows, but Hess does, is that Hitler is about to attack Russia. And maybe one of the reasons for this mission is they don't want to fight on two fronts because that hadn't really worked out very well for them in the First World War. So if they can get rid of Britain, make a peace with Britain, it'll give Hitler a free hand against the Soviets and Stalin. So all that's kind of swirling around. Another thing people should remember is that Britain is still very much alone at this point. Stalin and Hitler are still allies. America's not in the war. It's sending some aid to Britain, but it's had to kind of be dragged kicking and screaming even to do that. So, and Britain's had it's been a tough year. Rationing, bombing, U-boats, food shortages. You can understand, why people might have thought, let's make a peace. This is just dragging on too long, and it's a stalemate.
Certainly, I think from both our research, we see that these negotiations were going on right through 40, 41, and even into 42.
That's true. There was a serious peace initiative in 1940, which we actually talk about in one of our very early programs, all about 1940. But it's funny. I'm looking at 1945, and the way that the war is remembered is so different to what's actually going through people's minds. And we know what's going through people's minds because the Home Office are opening letters.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Listening to phone calls, and there's quite a lot of defeatism and fear in 40 and 41, especially 41. The thrill of the Battle of Britain, that's receded into memory, and now it's just a long grind. And all the, you know, the war in North Africa is not going well. So you can understand. You can understand why some people may have thought of, I don't think Churchill was ever one of them, but I know he wasn't. But some people who are very powerful probably were, and that's really what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, and it's not a subject, funny enough, that people have talked about recently. You know, the no new papers released. I don't think there's been a major book on it for some time.
Well, you and I have talked about this Tyler Kent story that one day we're going to do. You know, Churchill threw an awful lot of people into prison because he thought that they were, you know, very keen to make a peace deal or way too sympathetic to the Nazis. There was a lot of that going on.
Yeah, and to discourage anyone else, just to make an example.
That's right. Yeah. I tell you what we haven't done. We haven't mentioned our last program, which we usually do. Richard Norton Taylor hasn't got the biggest audience of any of our shows yet, but some very nice comments. Very nice. People really enjoyed it. Mary Olford, I think she's commented before. Welsh gal living in Texas. She loves our podcasts and the diversity of topics and the guests, that's very nice to hear. Thank you. Caroline Walker, another fascinating and deeply interesting podcast. Claudia Jinx says, why don't you do 2 a week and alternate it with 1 a week so that you don't get overstressed with your books, because we keep whinging about this. And we're not sure, frankly, whether we're going to continue with 2 a week. We might revert back. And we might keep chopping and changing. We just don't know. But yes, we're all grateful for all your comments. And do keep listening. And do keep subscribing. She's crept up again, actually, Andrew. We have a few hundred in the last couple of weeks, new subscribers.
Oh, good. Yes, we know. That's very important. The more subscribers we have, the better the algorithms look, and it's just right. It just helps us.
It helps us because we're very lucky that we can get access to people like Richard Norton Taylor and some of the other great writers and commentators and journalists we've had on. We can get that access because, well, some of them are friends, but others, you know, they see we have a platform. And the bigger that platform gets, the easier it will be to get really good guests.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, I think we've set the scene. We've done a bit of boasting about the last episode. Should we go back to 1941?
Let's go there.
Here we go. Whoa, mystery and intrigue incoming.
Well, we're delighted today to have John Harris talking about Rudolf Hess. He's just published, I think, your 7th book on the subject. It's a subject that's fascinated you for a long time. Can you tell us a little bit about why you're so fascinated and what are the new revelations in this book?
Sure. We first knew each other, Andrew, I think back in the late 90s, by which time Richard Wilborn and I had been trying to research the Hess affair for probably the best part of 10 years. We started simply because we didn't believe the official explanation. And the official explanation from the government, the German government communique on May the 12th, 1941, was that the deputy Führer, being delusional, had stolen a plane and flew to the enemy. And Richard and I just simply didn't believe that. We'd met some Germans in our professional careers, and certainly the ones we'd met didn't act like that, and we felt that that was certainly not the real reason for the flight back in 1941. On that basis, we started our work because at the time there was precious little published work of an independent nature. James Douglas Hamilton, who sadly just died, had published Motive for a Mission in 71, but that was very much trying to exonerate his father. Wolf Hess had written My Father, Rudolf Hess, in 1984, and that was basically saying that his father had been lured to Scotland. So apart from Peter Padfield, who I think you acted for as well, there was very little independent work on the topic. We started our work back in the mid-90s and soon found that there was a lot more going on behind the scenes than the official explanation. And 35 years later, I'm afraid we're still at it, but I think we now know a lot more than we did back in those days.
You mentioned the German official version, which is that this man had gone crazy and jumped on a plane and nobody else knew about it, and run off to try and talk to the enemy. What was the British official explanation at the time?
Well, that's the interesting question. There wasn't one. Churchill was spending the weekend at Ditchley Park. So if you contrast his approach to Hess flying in to when Barack Obama was sat in the bunker watching astutely as his commandos killed bin Laden, the contrast could not have been greater. And I'm afraid we believe now that Churchill wasn't in on this. He didn't know what was going on. And he was just as surprised as most of the population when the Deputy Führer of Germany crash-landed just outside Glasgow. In actual fact, Churchill was entertaining some pretty high-powered Americans as part of his strategy for getting them to come into the war. So it would have been pretty inconvenient, would it not, if at the same time there was the suggestion that he may be doing a backdoor piece with the enemy.
The story that's widely told is that Hess demands to see this guy Hamilton.
Well, that's right. But
do you believe that?
I do believe that. But don't forget, the Duke of Hamilton, whilst being the principal aristocrat in Scotland, has got no more ability to make a peace with anybody than you, me, or Andrew. At best, he could only have acted as a conduit for somebody else. Now, who that somebody else is clearly open to, who that somebody else is clearly open to speculation. But the Duke of Hamilton per se could not arrange anything particularly.
You say it's
except for, sorry, just to say, except for what he could have arranged was a seamless flight into Scotland for Hess. The Duke of Hamilton, as you're probably aware, was in charge of RAF Turnhouse on the night. And as such, he was basically in control of Scottish airspace from roughly the borders up to just north of Edinburgh. Now, I don't think he deliberately let Rudolf Hess fly in simply because he didn't need to. The air defences at that time, with that corridor between Newcastle and Edinburgh, were pretty bleak and non-existent, to be fair. So I don't think there was any... John Costello, an earlier Hess commentator, tried to make the case that he'd been deliberately let in by the Duke of Hamilton. I don't think he was deliberately let in. I just think there was no need to let him in because the air defences were not that great at that geographical location.
You raised the question of the fact the King and Queen's movements on the 10th of May are not known. I mean, is that significant?
Yes, I think it is. So what we do know now, after 30 years of trying, is where the senior members of the royal family were. So the Duke of Gloucester and Princess Alice had attended a parade in Huyck on the Saturday, the night that it all happened. They were staying with the Duke of Buccleuch, either at Drumlanrig or Bow Hill in the Borders. The Duke of Kent was ostensibly in the Orkney Isles, and we'd got Montagu Norman visiting his sister at Doic, which is about 20 miles away from Drumlanrig. And you could argue that there was a quorum of Privy Councillor members in and around Lowland Scotland that night. Now, whether or not what their intention was has clearly not come to the not become clear as yet, but there is a line of thought that the Duke of Hamilton and all Privy Councillors were then going to put pressure on the King to prorogue Parliament. And that sounds all very far-fetched, but don't forget Boris Johnson tried to prorogue Parliament only 5 years ago. Queen Victoria had prorogued Parliament previously and put pressure on prime ministers to do as she would wish. And Queen Victoria's tenure was only 40 years before Rudolf Hess flew in. Obviously, now we're talking a much longer period subsequently. It's 80 years since Hess flew in.
So the suggestion is that there was a kind of group of people at the top of the aristocracy, maybe including the royal family, privy councillors, who were keen to talk to Hess, who might be persuaded to do something constitutionally dramatic.
No, I think it's worse.
To clear the way to a peace deal. I mean,
I think it's worse than that, Peter. Phil, I think Hess came with a deal, and Hess had to come to be the physical manifestation of that deal. It's, you know, you could put a deal together through an embassy somewhere on the outskirts of Europe. So the question is, why did Hess see fit to have to fly to seal the deal? Well, I think it's so that it showed basically the credibility of the Germans to back that deal, because the British aristocracy would look pretty daft if they tried to make the King prorogue Parliament without Hess being under their control. The Germans could just say, well, no, we didn't want a peace in any case.
Did Hitler know about this?
Did what, sorry?
Did Hitler know about this?
I'm pretty confident, yes, he did. He was a consummate actor. This sort of deal would have been completely in his character, Andrew. You'll remember the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939. This is a very similar type of deal. The Molotov-Ribbentrop deal was the culmination of 6 months of intense diplomatic activity. And when it happened, it was a great surprise. Do not for a minute think that Hess just jumped in a plane and flew to Scotland. I think we can trace the Hess flight back to the 31st of August 1940, if not before. So the Hess flight was very much the culmination of a process that had been extant for probably 6 months before. Sorry, not 6 months, 9 months before.
Well, one thing I do know a little bit about 1940, if I'd written a book about it, and there were certainly peace deals offered, which were a very, very well-known story of the arguments in the war cabinet about the suggestion of a soft peace, and then various contacts. Rab Butler famously makes one in St. James's Park with a Swedish diplomat, I think, who's in touch with the Germans. And it's basically the same deal, isn't it? It's give us a free hand in Europe and we will leave the British Empire alone. In fact, we'll help you.
That's correct. Now, we know a little bit more about the peace deal that Hess was bringing with him because we know who drafted it. So Ernst Bohl, who was the chief of the Auslands organization in Nazi Germany. He was interrogated at Nuremberg and told the interrogators that he started drafting his Hess's peace plan in October of 40 and had finished it by January 41. And that's the peace deal that Hess brought with him and fell out of the plane. When the plane crashed, the peace deal was lost. And the farmer's wife at Flores Farm at Eaglesham writes to her sister saying that on the Sunday morning, i.e. the plane had crashed on the Saturday night, all hell let loose at Flores Farm because the police were desperately trying to find the peace deal that Hess had brought with him. And it was recorded that it was found, and it was found in a wee burn, apparently. And, of course, nobody has ever seen that piece of paper but since.
There needs to be two sides to a deal. Who has this deal been negotiated with? Not Churchill, I'm thinking. So who with?
Not Churchill, but that was the deal that Hess had brought with him. So presumably the negotiations had still either to be concluded formally or they'd been going on from the January through to the May of 41.
Because you talk also about certain circles and possibly rogue British intelligence involvement, but we've also got to remember that the following month Hitler invades Russia, and presumably if he'd done a peace deal with the British, that would have saved him one of his fronts from fighting on.
Yeah, and the interesting thing there, Andrew, is I think it would have had to have been a secret peace deal, wouldn't it? There wouldn't have been a great announcement and bells and whistles, because that would have alerted Stalin to exactly what was going on. Don't forget the British had been telling Stalin that the Germans were massing on the borders for some while, and for whatever reason, Stalin chose to do nothing about it. But it would be pretty blatantly obvious what was going to happen, I would suggest, if Hess had actually sealed a deal and it had been formally announced. I don't think that was ever going to happen. There would have been a treaty rather than an overt peace deal.
Also, the problem was
sorry, Andrew. I just find this so interesting because a lot of people don't realize 1941, when all this is happening, America isn't in the war. Russia and Germany are still allies. Soviet Union is still supposedly allies. Britain's very much alone. So, you know, you could understand why certain people at high places in Britain think that doing a peace deal would be sensible, especially because most of them hated the Bolsheviks anyway and would have been quite pleased to see Hitler beat Stalin, I think.
And John, I think you make a very good analogy with negotiations with Ukraine and Russia in 2022. Neither side has really got what they're hoping to get, and therefore it's not a good time to do a peace deal.
Spot on. There was no overwhelming ascendancy. You know, to be fair, Britain, the Germans were obviously trying to blitz Britain to the peace table, but they hadn't succeeded. I think we were creaking as a nation. There were rumours of civil discontent in Glasgow and Southampton after some bombing. So we were beginning to creak, but we hadn't broken. We hadn't ultimately broken. And the other point is that we really hadn't started to enjoy the benefits of the Empire troops. That came later. So we were certainly blooded. We were certainly on the ropes, but I don't think we were ultimately beaten badly enough to make it ultimately an attractive option. I think there was just a selfish upper strata in Great Britain to whom it did appear fundamentally attractive, because don't forget, they had got the most to lose. They were the major landowners. And if I was a major landowner in 1941, I think making a settlement might seem quite sensible. If I was going to lose my acres, castles and dogs, as it were. So I can understand the motivation. But the question is, did it actually happen? Is that what was actually going on in May 41.
But it all fell apart because he got lost, didn't he? I mean, the whole thing didn't happen in the way that it was planned because he crash landed in the wrong place.
Correct. He fell into government hands. And, you know, a lot of what we've been doing for the last 10 years has been on the technical flight, because we thought if we understood the character of the flight itself and learnt what was possible and what wasn't, we might get a clue as to whether or not it was an official, an officially sanctioned mission. Because, you know, be under no mistake, the Hess flight was meticulously planned. He'd availed himself of the most modern German navigation system, which was probably the best system in the world at that point in time for navigation. And that's unfortunately what he didn't understand. And he got lost over the North Sea, took another 40 minutes working out where he was precisely. And that's what led to his downfall. Because he was 40 minutes late, rather than landing in the dusk, he couldn't land because it was pitch dark. He'd gone over that window of opportunity, as it were.
So do you believe people were ready to meet him? If he'd landed where he'd planned to land, the authorities wouldn't have known, and he would have been whisked, taken away by these British co-conspirators somewhere.
Correct. Absolutely right. And I think we know where he was aiming to land. He was aiming to land at a RAF base called Dundonald. Now, Dundonald is just by Troon and Irvine on the West Ayrshire coast. Why do we think that's where he was heading? Well, that's where he nearly landed, point one. Point two, there is a flight map that was given by the Air Ministry to the Duke of Hamilton that now resides in Lennoxlove House in Haddington in Lothian. And we've studied this ruddy map until we sort of know it in our sleep. And there are various clues on that map which indicate that if you draw circles around particular waymarkers, all the circles bisect exactly at RAF Dundonald. So we were also given what purported to be Hess's flight plans by a human rights lawyer called A.W.B. Simpson. He was a friend of Peter Padfield, Andrew.
Friend of my father's.
Sorry?
Friend of my father's as well.
Really? Oh, right. Okay. So we were given an abridged version of these flight plans because Peter couldn't understand them. And after literally years of studying, we believe we know exactly what they indicate. And they just, again, prove that it was a meticulously planned flight that went wrong at what Hess called later the decisive moment. And he admitted that to his wife in one of the letters that he sent her from Spandau in the 1950s.
So who were these co-conspirators? Do you know? Or do you just...
We're happy to believe that Hess thought he was going to meet the Duke of Hamilton. Now, whether the Duke of Hamilton knew that is another moot point. But what we do know for sure is that MI6, Claude Danzy, was involved in the early stages of this operation. So there are clearly no archives which says, oh, yes, Claude Danzy had meticulously planned this right the way through. But one of the agents that had been used to communicate was Tancred Berenius, the Finnish art historian. And Danzy, I know, briefed Berenius before he went on his mission to Geneva in January of 1941. So we've got MI6 and Danzy all over this in the early stages.
Is this because MI6 were part of the conspiracy, or they were trying to deceive Hess and trick him?
Well, that's the killer question. That's the killer question. So we've distilled this down now to only two options. The first option is that there was a coup attempt underway on May the 10th that went disastrously wrong when Hess crashed. Or there was a coup attempt, but it was just, there was the illusion of a coup attempt, just purely aimed at buying time, so to stave off a German invasion of Britain. Those now, I believe, are the only two options here. We've discounted the doppelganger. That's now long gone.
Well, the idea that Hess was just an actor or somebody pretending.
Well, the idea that the chap in Spandau wasn't Rudolf Hess.
All right.
I think the DNA evidence now is pretty overwhelming that it was Hess, which doesn't really come as a great surprise to anybody, I don't
think.
But
you do make a very strong case for him being murdered rather than suicide.
Well, we'll never know that, Andrew. So after Hess died, and he undoubtedly died, the British commissioned an autopsy, and that was carried out by a chap called Cameron. And Cameron was a top-notch surgeon, but his reputation was a little bit tainted because he'd been involved in the Australian dingo scandal, if you remember that, and he'd got that wrong. So I don't know if that's why the Hess family then commissioned another autopsy 2 days after father had died, and that was by a Dr. Spahn of Munich University, both eminently qualified to do the job. Cameron said that Hess had hung himself, and Spahn had said that he thought because the bruising around the back of the neck was horizontal, that it indicated to him asphyxiation rather than hanging. So I'm afraid you pay your money and takes your choice on that. The British reacted by withdrawing the death certificate, so technically Rudolf isn't dead. It's fascinating. We don't know. I don't think we'll ever know. I mean,
I'm just being rude now because I don't want to jump to the end. I'm still trying to get my head around this coup that may or may not have been taking place. Various aristocrats, privy councillors in Scotland, possibly the king. Does the king have some sympathy to this faction? Perhaps he does. Hess thinks he's got a deal with them, flies in, doesn't meet them, gets captured by the police, coup collapses. And the coup would have been, we prorogue Parliament, somebody arrests Churchill.
No, not necessarily. I don't think there's any need to arrest Churchill. You could give Churchill a quiet tap on the shoulder and say, right, Winston, you've done very well, but we've had enough of this, and let's now regain our senses, please. That might well have happened. And that brings you then on to the relationship of Churchill with the monarch. And, you know, be in no doubt, Churchill was disliked intensely, particularly by the Queen Mother after the abdication crisis. Andrew will know far more about this than I. But there was certainly no love lost between Churchill and the royal family in the early stages of the war. When it all panned out and it looked as if we were winning, yes, the United Front was there. But there's a film called The Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman that explores the period post-Dunkirk and the relationship of the King and Churchill. And I'm afraid I just don't believe the palliness that is portrayed in that period. Yes, the two men had got to work together constitutionally, but I don't think they were particularly close at that point in time at all.
Interesting. That is so.
The King was associated with Chamberlain, and also, of course, Churchill didn't really have a great deal of a power base in the Conservative Party. I mean, he was propped up by Labour.
Absolutely. He was completely disliked, in fact, I think.
Oh, yeah. The real power, a lot of people really would have gone with Lord Halifax in 1940.
Absolutely.
1941. And it was only really, I think, the Labour Party that kept that show on the road. When things really seemed, you know, Dunkirk hadn't even happened. It was just about to happen, wasn't it? And they nearly took that deal. I mean, nobody quite knows how close they got.
Spot on.
And I think for Churchill, all his many crimes and mistakes, and we dealt with some of those in a previous episode, standing firm at that time, that was his great contribution to history.
Absolutely.
No doubt.
I'm a great Churchill fan, more so if I'm right, and he chose to keep his mouth shut about what had happened with the royal family attempting to unseat him.
Well, I find this actually quite plausible. I don't know the ins and outs. I think you're absolutely right. The United Front really comes in after America joins the war. And all of this is taking place before that. And people forget just how exposed Britain was.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Circling, you know, we had no money. We were being beaten in the desert by rubble. It was a really bad time.
Well, also, your book is meticulous in laying out the story. I mean, a lot of it has to be speculation, but I think, you know, you and it's a very complicated story, but I think you pull the pieces together very well.
Well, we try not to speculate. We only try and say what we know and can prove. And can I just make one point that I think is jolly important but has been missed up until very recently? And that is the role of the Polish government in exile, because I think there were peace negotiations going on. I think that's what Hess was all about. But that's just what John Harris thinks. The Polish government in exile, as soon as they discovered that Hess had crash-landed, they convened a very high-powered meeting for them. Essentially, the Polish government in exile met at Moncrief House, just by Perth. Sikorski, the prime minister, had flown in from the US on May the 11th and bizarrely had landed at Prestwick, 20 miles away from where Hess had crashed. He went to Moncrief House. The leader of the Polish army in exile, who was a General Sosnowski, pardon my pronunciation, was in London. He jumped on the nearest train and got himself to Moncrief House. And they met there, I guess, Monday, Tuesday, after the Saturday night crash. And what did they decide to do? And this is fantastic. They decided that they were going to go and launch an attack, kidnap Hess and murder him. And that's not John Harris saying that. That was the assistant MI5 officer, Guy Liddell. And it's recorded in his diaries, which were published in 2005. So whatever John Harris thinks was going on, the Poles, who were in a pretty good position to know the truth, had decided that they were going to go and kill Hess, which in a strange way makes a lot of sense if you're a Pole, because the Poles were frightened to death that the West, Britain in particular, would do a peace with Germany and sail Poland down the river. Now, the peace deal that Boal had drafted, that Hess brought with him, insisted on some form of Poland being part of that deal. So you could argue that their fears were a little overstated, but given what happened in 1945-46, you can see exactly why the Poles thought they might be sold down the river. Well, and
you mentioned Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. They must have thought, here we go again. The
Absolutely.
Great powers are going to do a deal over our heads, stitch us up again. And yes, you're right. That's so interesting.
And to be fair, they weren't far wrong, were they? And
by the end of the war, they were.
You know, one of the most shameful things was that the Polish army were denied the opportunity to march in the victory parade in 1945-46, I think, because it was deemed to be embarrassing to Stalin.
Yeah.
So it's not a great leap of faith, is it, to see why the Poles wanted to launch that assassination attempt. As it was, they failed, and they failed, quite interestingly, because MI6 had got an officer embedded within the Polish government in exile who told MI6 what was going on. And that's why Hess moved to the Tower of London 2 days early. So the assassination attempt was going to be on May the 19th. And Hess was moved on May the 17th to London. And he went to the Tower of London under the control of MI6. And the other supreme irony there is he was held in the same room in the Tower of London as Guy Fawkes was the last inhabitant 400 years earlier. So you could argue that if you're looking to upset the state of Great Britain, that's where you're going to end up, because both men had the same room, albeit 400 years apart.
Wouldn't it have suit the British authorities for Hess to actually have died? I mean, rather than keep him imprisoned for the next 50 years,
well,
wouldn't that have been a neat solution?
Well, that is a very good point. And the assassination squad was headed by two Englishmen. Now, Liddell names one of them, and he names him to be a chap called Alfgar Hesketh Pritchard. His father wrote the definitive book on sniping in World War I, and his grandson is, I think, head of the Countryside Alliance today. So clearly that theme continues. But Alfgar Hesketh Pritchard was noted as being seemingly on the Polish side. He later became part of SOE, which, of course, was very much a sop to the Labour Party coalition, because the Labour Party didn't trust MI6, not unsurprisingly, it has to be said. So you could make the case that SOE were part of the plot to kill Hess. And apparently they had another go back in later in 1942, at which time Hess was down in Aldershot at a place called Mitchett Place. So there's all sorts of underlying political tensions just surrounding the captivity of Hess, let alone what Hess was actually
doing. Well, it was always suspicious that even long after the war, everything was always done to stop him talking.
Precisely.
He was never really threatened. I mean, obviously, he was a prisoner. He'd been involved. He was tried at Nuremberg. You know, he'd been involved in one of the worst regimes in history. Of course, he deserved to be punished. But there seemed to be a sense that he just had to keep him quiet.
Very good. So at Nuremberg.
Thank you very much. Oh, Spanglemonger's coffee. How lovely. Thank you, darling. Sorry.
So at Nuremberg, Hess's treatment is very well documented by a chap called J.R. Rees, who was his appointed doctor stroke psychiatrist. And J.R. Rees, in his book, The Case of Rudolf Hess, which was published in 1947, which is very early for a Hess book, makes the case that they were administering drugs to Rudolf Hess. And they actually list the drugs that were being administered. And we've obviously looked at what those drugs were and their side effects. And I am not surprised about the performance that Hess put on at Nuremberg. You would think, would you not, that if you were on trial for your life and you wanted to be seen as a good guy trying to end the war with a peace deal as early as 1941, you would at least mention that fact. Hess never mentioned it at all. Instead, he just kept going on about how people had been drugged at the Russian show trials in the late 30s in under Stalin's purge. At no time did he say, well, I flew to Scotland because I wanted to meet the Duke of Hamilton, who was going to take me to the king, and this was going to end the slaughter. And then obviously post Nuremberg, he ended up at Spandau, where he was incarcerated for 22 years later, longer than the next serving prisoner, who was Speer, who got released in 1966. So you're absolutely right, Phil. He was just silenced. And there's a big story about who was actually trying to make sure that Hess stayed in Spandau. The British blame the Russians, and the Russians blame the British.
Very handy.
Very
handy.
It's quite convenient, isn't it?
But also the archives are missing. I mean, there's so many records that either haven't been released or seem to have disappeared, which raises sort of questions.
Yes, well, you're probably aware that I've had a spat with Professor Sir Richard Evans, Andrew, and he says that the classic trait of a conspiracy theorist is to allude to missing documentation and records. But unfortunately with Hess, there's a list, and I listed them in the last book, of 28 documents that we're not alluding to. We know that they existed, and they now no longer exist. So I apologise if that's conspiratorial. I just think it's stating the facts.
Well, I mean, David Stafford, who's an author of mine, who also wrote a book on Hess, working in the Foreign Office in the 60s, actually was responsible for getting rid of many of these records. I mean, he's spoken about that.
Yes, because, you know, let's not lose sight of the fact, if hypothetically we are correct and there was a non-governmental peace deal being concluded in spring of 1941, I can understand why that secret would never come out. You know, literally millions of people lost their lives as a result, you could argue, of what happened at Eaglesham Golfing Club on May the 10th, 1941. So, you know, out of respect for all of the people that have died, I can understand why the secret may never be openly admitted.
Well, you also talk about the Queen, I mean, the Duke of Kent's possible involvement. And I mean, he was spoken about as a sort of King of Poland, but also Queen Mary seems to have been certainly sort of following what was going on. And that clearly would be very embarrassing to the monarchy if that came out.
Yeah, I think the Queen Mary was very close to Berenius. They used to go, after George V died, Queen Mary and Berenius would go on shopping trips in and around Yorkshire, buying antiques. So there's no doubt Berenius was very close to her. He also knew the Duke of Kent, and that's why we've been trying so hard to find out where the Duke of Kent was on the night. There was a book, you're probably aware of it, Andrew, called Double Standards, which was published in 2002. That's Stephen Pryor, Lynn Picknett, Clive Prince and Rob Brydon. And in some ways, that's a good book, but I'm afraid I think it's got a complete lie. That put the Duke of Kent at the end of the runway at Dungavel House, where the Duke of Hamilton lived. And I'm afraid I just think that is a outright lie. I just don't believe that in the slightest. We tried to find out exactly where the Duke of Kent was. They wouldn't tell us. The royal family wouldn't tell us. The secretary blamed it on a loss of the diary. But thankfully, with the internet, we managed to trace him to the Orkney Isles through a wartime publication called the Orkney Blast. And it was a weekly rag that was published for the serving forces of the Orkney Isles, and that records an official record, an official visit by the Duke of Kent on the day in question, on May the 10th, 1941.
Well, if there was a big plot, if there was, that would have been a handy place to be, wouldn't it? But the home of the Royal Navy at Scarborough.
Well, very, very, very bizarrely, and I am going to apologise for what I'm about to say, because it is conspiratorial. The Duke of Kent was, in the spring of 41, an inspecting officer of the Royal Air Force. He'd been in the Royal Navy, but he'd left that, and his job was to go around RAF bases to hopefully improve morale and report on their efficiency. When he went to the Orkney Isles, he was yet again dressed as a Rear Admiral of the Fleet. Now, if you wanted to be really conspiratorial, you could say that he had got the senior rank on in charge of a British Home Fleet on the 10th of May 1941. That's could be complete nonsense, for which I apologise in advance.
Well, it's intriguing.
But it is a fact.
Well, there's so much of this about, and again, they didn't want to talk about it.
That is a fact.
The level of sympathy for Hitler at the higher levels of the British upper class, you know, is something people didn't want to talk about after the war.
Late, I think what's fascinating is, and I found lots of peace negotiations still going on in 1941. I mean, 18 months after the spring and summer 40 negotiations.
So your man, the Duke of Windsor, of course. I mean, you know, he was very well plugged in to those circles, one assumes. We all know about him. He was a Nazi sympathizer, totally. And that's why Churchill had packed him off to the Caribbean, which Andrew's written very well about.
Absolutely.
Was he in any way connected? Do we know? I mean, he would have loved it, I'm sure.
We've traced his movements. I've tried to just drill. All we do is drill down into detail. So we try and find out where people were. So we know that Halifax was on a ranch that weekend, because he was another contender for something to happen. We know that Hoare was in the Spanish embassy in Madrid that weekend. But Samuel Hoare has got all sorts of strange movements leading up to that point in time as well. I think Hoare is a potential candidate for a Churchill replacement, certainly.
I mean, he had an intelligence background. He'd been foreign secretary. And as you say, basically, Churchill kicked all these people into exile to keep them off out of the way.
Spot on. The King and Queen were ostensibly at Windsor that weekend. But what I find interesting in that, William Shawcross, the Queen Mother's biographer, says that they were apparently at Windsor that weekend. And I never quite understand why you use the word apparently. They either were or they weren't. So whether he knows more than he's letting on, I don't know. But I have to say the likely explanation is that that is where they were, yes.
Gosh, and what's been the reaction to the book? Because, I mean, there's some pretty important new developments here. Have people sort of responded to this? I mean, Richard Evans trying to discredit it and in fact getting some basic facts wrong himself.
No, so what happened with Richard Evans? Richard Evans had got a book to sell himself, and a lot of what he wrote was very, very good indeed. But he wrote a chapter on Hess. He was debunking conspiracy theorists. And he wrote a chapter on Hess, his chapter 4, which was basically almost devoted to Richard Wilborn and myself. And in so doing, he got basic facts wrong as well, which just, in my eyes, made it lose any credibility it may have had in the first place. So he was trying to make out that Duke of Kent had been killed on a training exercise, which I think we all know was certainly not the case. But academia at that level, Andrew, I think is a different kettle of fish in that Richard Evans had a grant of £1.5 million from the Leverhulme Foundation to research conspiracy and the truth. And so I guess we would just see unwitting targets of his paid researchers.
Well, if this chap Evans was with us now, he'd probably say, you know, the received wisdom was the truth, that he was a lone mission. Hess was
that's exactly
ill. He may have met Hamilton, but there was no great peace deal. He might have wanted one, but there was nothing except in his imagination. That's what he would say, yeah?
Absolutely. And, you know, you could invite him onto your show. That would be quite entertaining as well, I think. So,
Nazi week, Andrew.
But also the fact that so many of these people were gathered in the lowlands, you know, is slightly odd at that particular time. It may be a coincidence. But clearly, though, and the communications you show were going on with various intermediaries, because I mean, there's the whole backup to this of the arrangements, you know, up to May 41, and the attempts to bring Hess across. I mean, it looks much more like he didn't come from his own volition. I mean, he was encouraged to come.
Oh, definitely, and you know, the fact that his plane was loaded up with the latest electronic equipment. Somebody would have had to have taught him how to do that. His plane was also amended specifically for something called a pitot tube. And again, this is recorded in the Messerschmitt records. So at the very least, there's collusion between the Messerschmitt aircraft factory and the deputy Führer. And I can't believe in a totalitarian state that the secrecy would have remained at that close level. Because
the other thing is, you know, Hess has had a record second to none of loyalty to Hitler.
Yes,
he'd been in from the very beginning. I think he was at the beer hall in 1923. He'd been in prison with him. I think. I mean, he was a diehard Nazi. So would he just take off by himself? Without Hitler saying, go for it, mate, off you go. No. Here's a nice plane.
Well, the other thing that we did discover, and I'm absolutely convinced this is right as well, is that the Hess plane could not have flown from Augsburg to Eaglesham directly. And that's not a question of fuel. A lot of authors have written in the past, oh, well, the Messerschmitt 110 couldn't hold enough fuel. Yes, it could, because you fitted underwing auxiliary fuel tanks, and that gave you the sufficient range for fuel. But what the 110 desperately required, because it was what was called a dry sump. So in the modern car, the oil goes around the engine and back to the sump. In Hess's plane, the oil goes around the engine and out the bottom at a rate of between 5 and 9 litres per hour. And the tanks behind the engine hold 35 litres. So Hess only had got enough oil for around 4 to 5 hours. Now, the flight, as documented, was 5.5 hours. So we are pretty confident that he actually landed, and we think we know the airfield. It was a place called Gießen in northern Germany. That makes a flight possible and achievable. And straight away, once you start introducing landings en route...
You need authority for that.
You're in... of course you are. You need a collusion, approval, authority, and words such as that.
Wow. I mean, well, what a great conversation.
I mean, yeah. No, that's... We've been going for ages. I mean, the death... you call for an inquiry there, because, I mean, he was a man in his 90s, who had never shown any signs, really, of wanting to kill himself. And, I mean, you even have his Tunisian nurse actually going on the record saying that he thought he was murdered. So, yeah. I mean, you're being quite careful here, but it seems to me from the evidence you produce in your book that this was not a suicide.
Quite possibly, but...
Before, Andrew. Maybe it's just my Wikipedia level of knowledge. I thought in the 50s he once took an overdose.
Possibly. Then that's the suicide note was written then that's found on his body, yes.
Yeah. I don't know if Hess was murdered or committed suicide. I think the evidence would support murder over suicide for sure. Apparently he was so arthritic he couldn't even tie his shoelaces, and yet... we're led to believe that he put an electric cord around his neck and fell forwards from a height of 18 inches and asphyxiated and hung himself. So it's no, I'm not going to say one way or another because there's not sufficient evidence.
That can be your next book, John.
What is the next book? Are you going to carry on? Is there more research to be done, or do you think this is the I wouldn't say the final solution?
Please don't.
No, don't say that, Andrew. Next book, we're still carrying on. So the current leads We went to Norway a fortnight ago to prove the existence of the electric radio navigation system. We managed to find the site of that, which was great and really interesting. What I'm trying to do at the moment, you're obviously aware of Sir John Anderson, the Home Secretary. He had the Penny Mordaunt role in May 1941. He was the head of the Privy Council. And I think if I was a member of a royal family, I'd want to be seen to be doing what I was going to do constitutionally as well. And I think that might involve John Anderson. Now, interestingly enough, John Anderson met the king on May the 9th, the day before the Hess flight. And what I would very much like to know is where John Anderson was on May the 10th, 1941. What's quite interesting, like yourself, Andrew, he's a fellow Scot, and his father was an old man living in Edinburgh. Now, it would be quite interesting, would it not, if we could demonstrate that John Anderson made his way to Scotland that day as well. I can't prove that at all. I don't know. The Anderson archives are pretty difficult to get into, and they're probably more difficult as a result of this morning. But that's our next step, to try and find out who else was there. And also what I want to do is try and get a bit of local knowledge about the airfield. So we typically write to farmers because they tend to stay around in situ for long periods of time, just to see if there's any gossip on the ground as to what was happening at RAF Dundonald and Dungavel House. My secretary, who's been with me all the way through this, often says, you know, John, it will be the servants that give the game away, not the key players. And I think she's probably right. And that's the focus of our research at the moment.
Can I wish you good luck?
Have people come forward, you know, as a result of the book, saying my father told me this story? Or
if I had a pound for everybody that told me they'd guarded Hess in Spandau, I'd be a wealthy man. And if I had a pound for every time somebody told me in the Borders that they'd seen the Hess plane fly over, I'd be a wealthy man. But we haven't had any deathbed revelations as yet. And I'll tell you why. I don't think many people were involved in this. I think on the British side, I would put money on Brenius being involved. I think there was communication going on post-January 41 in Geneva and Arosa in Switzerland. But you don't actually need many people to mount a constitutional coup. The king just needs to be sure when he's doing it that he thinks he's got right on his side and the population on his side. And that's another tricky point, because although Churchill had got no favour with his own party at all until much later in the war, you know, he'd just survived a vote of no confidence on May the 7th, 41, which I don't think is a coincidence. He had another vote of confidence in May later in 42, I think. So certainly Churchill's position was far from secure as well. I've lost my thread there.
I think we've also lost our slot because it's nearly an hour. So
Sorry.
We should probably wrap it up. But it is very good. I really enjoyed it.
Recommend his book, which we'll be talking about.
I can show you that. That's the latest one. And then we've got one that will attract the aeronautical brigade, and that's all about German radio navigation systems. Can I just say, it's just been a fantastic hobby over a long period of time. We've met a lot of interesting people. And when we started this in 1987, I think we knew bugger all about bugger all, really. And I think our knowledge has increased, not exponentially, but I think we're far better placed now to say what we think than we were in 1987. So, no, it's been a lot of fun.
It's been a long journey. Well, in some ways, you've worked from first principles. You've come with no assumptions.
Absolutely.
That perhaps has allowed you to look at things in a slightly different way.
Spot on. Yeah. No, spot on.
All right.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice to see you. All the best.
Okay. See you later. Bye.
Well, that's quite a story. Complicated, but he explained it, I think, pretty clearly and well.
No, I'm ready to be convinced. I know there are other historians who don't agree with him. And, you know, conspiracy theories, because it is a conspiracy theory, often are, you know, over-elaborate and unrealistic. But I think the core elements of this do sound believable to me.
Yeah, I mean, he does pull his pieces together in the book. I mean, it's very detailed forensic. He's an accountant. And, yeah, I think it all does hold together. You know, the problem was, you know, simple thing. Old Hest lost his way, and that kind of changed the whole thing. I mean, I suppose trying to work out what might have happened if the coup had begun. He did an earlier book, which was much more about the luring by British intelligence, which the theory then was it was a sort of trap. Mm. But it now looks like you know, there were serious players there. You know, and also just the secrecy around this is rather baffling. But
well, that's the thing. For decades after the war, I mean, really, from the moment he's arrested in 1941 till the moment he dies, there is enormous trouble taken to make sure he never speaks once to an independent person. So what he's carrying around in his head is deemed so important, even when he's very, very old and the war's been over for 30 or 40 years, that he must be guarded.
Yeah. I
mean, that's really interesting.
I never really had access. And you know, there were books, for example, by the people who were guarding him in Spandau, you know, who, you know, do back up the fact that he was a serious person. He wasn't mad. And, yeah, it's an intriguing story. I mean, I wonder if we'll ever know the full truth. I mean, if the papers will ever merge.
Well, it's one for that. The mysterious file. You know, we've got a little playlist. I'm going to put it right into that one, I think, because it's
up there with Lord Errol.
Yes, Lord Errol and Lord Lucan and all sorts of unsolved mysteries. For that's what it is, an unsolved mystery. Very intriguing to talk about. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that a lot. We've got some more things.
We've got a change of tack, haven't we, next time?
I've completely forgotten what we're doing next.
Sport.
We are doing sport.
Your beloved Manchester United.
Yes, my beloved Manchester United.
Snooker and Sheffield.
I shouldn't have said that. I've probably just lost about 1,000 subscribers who support Liverpool. Sorry, guys. Yeah, Man United and also snooker. So we're doing a sports episode. Clive Irving's coming back soon. He talked about the royal racism allegations. And he's very well informed on anything to do with British journalism. And he's going to talk about hacking and the Murdoch press and Prince Harry's battles with them. And where all that stands, which is going to be controversial and interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a good chance that some journalists may go to prison, or you know, that Harry may win.
Yeah, I think Harry may win. I don't know whether they'll end up in prison, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me. We've mentioned before Hannah Barnes is coming on in a couple of weeks to talk about the Tavistock, the treatment for trans children at the Tavistock, which is incredibly divisive and complicated story, but she's written an amazing book about it. And then our favourite, Lady Colin is back soon to talk about her new book, which is about, guess what, the royal family.
Yep, Meghan and Harry. And then we've got Sex in Ancient Rome.
Sex in Ancient Rome. It's all here. It is, actually. And we're enjoying ourselves and we're enjoying telling you these stories. Well, this has been quite a long episode. Is there anything else to say?
No, I think you know, just you know, look forward to hearing more comments. Thanks for your support. Please subscribe and look forward to seeing you next week.
Indeed. Right. Gin and tonic time. Bye.
Yep, absolutely. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team at podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.